Thanks for tuning in to Backseat's Musical Podcast. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to it, like it, share it with everyone you know, and if you can leave a big fat review, that would be awesome. Also, make sure you check out Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for our regular updates on what's coming up next on future episodes. You can also email me at backs@rock102.com. I'd love to hear what you think. Today's episode is brought to you by Metro Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram in Chicopee. Visit Metro's state-of-the-art dealership ranks to BJ's and Big Y on Memorial Drive, or visit MetroJeep.com and drive home in your new Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram today.
Backseat's Musical Podcast.
Resistance is useless.
One of the things that's become pretty obvious to me over the years is that there really isn't a formula involved in being a successful artist. Otherwise, everybody would be doing it. A lot of things need to be in place, and we've certainly talked about this before. You need an undefinable and relentless combination of incredible luck, ambition, tenaciousness, talent, loads of people supporting what you do. You got to be at the right place at the right time, and you need an audience that gives a damn. And oh yeah, you also need someone to pay for it. If you can put all those things together, then there's a remote chance you'll become a modest success. Other than that, it's pretty easy. But you also need to be ready to seize upon opportunities when they come. 20 years ago, the band The Dandy Warhols were featured in a documentary that was given the Grand Jury Prize of the Sundance Film Festival. The 2004 documentary was called Dig, and the film focused on two brilliant bands from Portland, Oregon, bulldozing their way in two entirely different directions. On one hand, you had the amazing Brian Jonestown Massacre, who, despite all of their unbelievable talent and promise, repeatedly stumbled their way into a sad path of self-sabotage. But then you had the Dandy Warhols, who were able to keep their shit together and avoid many of the same pitfalls, and were able to release a bunch of insanely great records over the last 29 years, including 2001's 13 Tales from Urban Bohemia, 1997's Come Down, and 2003's Welcome to the Monkey House. That's not to say there haven't been a few bumps along the way. There certainly have. But over the years, the band has stayed largely intact. They've remained focused, productive, and successful, especially in Europe and other parts of the world. Strangely enough, through no fault of their own, their music has not had the same commercial impact at home. That's largely due to a music industry that has become rather dysfunctional over the years, and certainly no reflection of the quality of their music. In fact, in my own opinion, with songs like 1997's Not If You Were the Last Junkie on Earth and 2001's Bohemian Like You, or the 26 other incredible singles from their dozen studio albums that they released over the last three decades, the Dandy Warhols are simply one of the best and most enduring rock bands in America. There, I said it. The Dandy Warhols have just released their latest album called Rockmaker, and in all honesty, it is arguably one of the best albums of their career. What's even more incredible is that it's not just loaded with great songs. They were also able to assemble an amazing lineup of guest appearances for the record, too. A lineup that includes some astounding work from Slash from Guns N' Roses, Black Francis from the Pixies, and Debbie Harry from Blondie. The band is already on a brief tour for Rockmaker, a tour which already saw stops in both Hamden, Connecticut, and Boston earlier this month. That's why I'm so excited to speak to my guest today, the songwriter, leader, and lead singer for the Dandy Warhols, Courtney Taylor Taylor, on Backseat's Musical Podcast. I've been listening to the record for the last couple of weeks. I think it's absolutely amazing, and there's a lot to talk about in this thing. The least of which is it's the shortest album you've done in about 5 years.
Ever.
How difficult was it to keep an album under 3 hours?
You know, since we couldn't keep the previous record under 3 hours, it was real easy.
The first couple of singles are great, and the one that a lot of people are talking about is I'd Like to Help You With Your Problem, featuring Slash. He's such a distinctive guitar player that when you hear it, you're like, holy shit, there's no question of who that is.
Yeah, what that he is, you know, I'm hearing so much back about it, and, you know, people saying, I'm a huge Slash fan, and I've never heard him play like that, but I would know it anywhere.
Yeah.
It's really strange, like somebody trying to disguise their voice, and you're just like, Uncle Mike, get out of the closet, you know, whatever. I know it's you. Yeah, it's really... it's really amazing what that term voice, you know, when people talk about, you know, a solo performer, when they talk about their, you know, an instrumentalist as their voice, it really is case in point right there. I remember people talking about how, you know, every decade or so, somebody pops out with Mick Jagger's, the voice of his soul is not his voice. It's actually him playing harmonica. And I thought that was a really, I've thought about that a lot because I really feel like, you know, I spent my life being a drummer. I just ended up doing this just because Pete kind of, you know, kind of pushed me into it.
Yeah.
Because I was I recorded and did a lot of studio work just on my own and had collected a lot of gear. And I really liked that. So I was making music that nobody would ever hear. And Peter moved back from New York and wanted to, I had just finished music college. So he pointed out that all my friends were music college friends and they had terrible taste in music. And okay, why don't we just play your songs? Let's put a band together and play your songs that you don't play for anyone. So that we can meet people that listen to Galaxy 500 and T-Rex. That's what his excuse for putting the Dandy Warhols together was. But I really feel like drums and percussion are the voice of my soul.
And it's really something when someone is so distinctive of a musician that you can identify them without even, you know, seeing their name. He would be a guy that you would definitely say, okay, I've heard all the Guns N' Roses stuff. But if you've ever seen him live, you realize he's not just a good guitar player. He is a sensational guitar player. And when he puts a solo together, it can only be Slash. That's what the amazing thing about him is. And I know that when you recorded it and you heard what he had done, you guys were all kind of, you know, flabbergasted by how just brilliant it is.
Yeah, it's really deep and broad. You know, there's like all sorts of, you know, modal Middle Eastern scales he's going to in that. Well, he really lays it on in the breakdown part. He cuts out and then just Spartan quick, Middle Eastern runs of scales and things. And then we reverbed those out and they're, you know, but the whole thing, it's not, I guess people expected shredding, you know, and he just is classically playing and it's textural. A lot of it is, you know, this stereo wah-wah kind of trippy texture thing. And then with maybe like some really beautifully, perfectly chosen note, you know, coming out of it and then back to the trippy, you know, and it's a stunner. I will never in my life tire of listening to it. I've only heard it about 1,000 times since we got the record done here. And it's become rather apparent to me that I will never tire of listening to it.
How did you get them?
Just, you have your people contact their people and, you know, it's a Hail Mary, you know, we're not a stadium act or anything, you know, like that. We never have been. So, but we're a art rock band and other artists that are into artsy rock tend to like us. We're friends with most everybody that we ever wanted to be, you know, from Robert Smith to, you know, all the great greats that have passed recently, from, you know, David, Tom Petty, Joe Strummer. We got to be friends with everyone, Oasis to, you know, so it's worth it for us to try.
One of there's a couple of other guest appearances on the album that are really notable. One is Black Francis or Frank Black or Charlie, whatever he wants to be called, on Dancing with Myself, which I think is like one of the best song titles in I can remember. I just think it's a great song, but the song title is so hilarious.
We couldn't stop with that one. That was because the riff is very kind of like Danzig 4, sludgy. It's just a sludge fest, really. Yeah. And so that became Danzig with Myself. And, you know, we had other names for it and pull lyrics out. Let's call it this. And let's say this is nothing. Nothing was as good. So that's why is still called that, even though it veered away from all the stuff that got layered on top of that original riff, kind of went Pixies-ish. And that's why I thought we should get, you know, Charles on that.
As opposed to calling up, you know, Glenn Danzig.
Yeah. Well, I love Glenn's vocal style. You know, he is such a truly unique beast. Nobody does that. Nobody does, you know, even in the Misfits, it was like kind of pop punk with a vocalist that has far more in common with the Rat Pack or Jim Morrison than with Johnny Rotten.
Yeah.
You know,
I always thought it was like, you know, electrified type of 50s type of song, especially those early Misfits songs. I mean, they're just, it's like Elvis.
Right. Yeah. And if the Ramones were, you know, they were obviously super into the, they thought, I think in their minds, they probably believed that they were making Motown singles. And our song that went that way on this record, went 50s with the chord changes, and the melody is called Love Thyself.
I think my favorite song on the album, and having listened to it a couple of times, I've convinced myself, and the story behind this is interesting, because there's a guest appearance on this. It's been cloaked in mystery for quite a while, but Debbie Harry is with you guys, and I Will Never Stop Loving You, which I actually think may be my favorite song on that record. How did you, first of all, tell me about working with Debbie Harry, and what was the reasoning behind, or the rationale behind the holding back of that information that she was going to be on this record?
When you have three towering icons of rock history on your record, you don't want to blurt it out all at once, because then it's only news once. And in this fucked up world with the amount of crap on the internet, and you know, the world is just covered with a thick fog of greasy gray crap, and you can't be heard in it, you can't scream loud enough in it,
yeah,
into it be heard. So, you know, time, you know, there's time, and then there's volume, and we don't have, you know, the power to blast as big as Beyonce or Taylor Swift or whatever, you know? So we have to do it by trying to have some hang time.
Yeah.
And you release, you know, the Black Francis song, the most avant-garde track on the record. You do that first. It's the most unusual. And you don't mention anything else, and you just work that and create, and that gets interest. That's wow. Okay. That's a really cool, you know, hookup. And then a month later, you release the Slash track. And, you know, and that's also a fairly unique beat, just in that nobody's really going for Vietnam vet rock and a sound, and not trying to be modern and not trying to be hipster with it at all. Just really trying to capture that, what I love, or what we love about that era and those kinds of bands. And then a month later, you release the record, and you release the Debbie Harry track. It's interesting that you felt that you think that's your favorite song, because the first interview I did where it got brought up was with the NME in the UK, and the kid looked like he was about 20 years old. That interviewed me, and he was Scottish, and the first thing he said was, mate, the song with Debbie Harry, I've listened to it like 10 times a day,
yeah,
since I got the PR sent me the record. He was just blown away by it too. So yeah, that's, I'm glad we did have a couple other record labels, you know, that were interested in the record, of course, before before we settled with this one. No big, you know, no majors or old Titan, you know, those dinosaurs, those big boys. They're kind of looking for young pop artists now. But the cool indie labels, there was a little problem with how long that song was, and I don't know if it's going to be a single. It's just, you know, and I had to explain to them that, you know, we were at Capitol Records when Radiohead did not turn in Creep 2.
Yeah, right.
And they were just sitting there. They had nothing. No one had released or had turned in any records. Everyone was still recording, you know, the Foo Fighters, the Beastie Boys, or, you know, all their big acts were, you know, deep in the studio and weren't going to have a record done for, you know, months or a year or years, who knows. And Radiohead, you know, oh, they had a big hit, you know, great. And they turned in this record, and everyone just kind of looked at each other with this blank stare and didn't know what to do. And Bruce Kirkland, who was really, really a brilliant, brilliant man, he was the GM of Capitol at the time. And our A&R guy said, because he was a Radiohead's A&R as well, he said that it was very interesting what they decided to do, because Bruce Kirkland looked at the entire top tier of Capitol Records and just said, all right, then what's the most emotionally powerful piece of music on this record that's all single? Yeah. And Perry said that all the assistants that were in, the young people, started tittering and tittering, and they said, fake plastic trees. It's amazing. Oh, it's so beautiful. And he went, all right, there's a single.
Yeah.
And that was it. That Radiohead was born. They were not a pop act after that. You know, they were a deep and powerful musical experience. And that was how they got to be approached and thought of for the entire rest of their careers.
Yeah.
You know,
when I heard it, you know, it's such an atmospheric type of song that it was like, literally, I think the first time I heard it, it was literally like, you know, the hairs on your back stand up. And it's like, you know, you could just feel the right energy of that song. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, I connected with it in a way where, you know, I mean, the whole record's great, but I think that was the one that certainly caught me. She did a wonderful job, you know, with her vocal too.
Yeah, we, in the mixing, that was really cool to mix, to try to make sure that we didn't have any kind of like slick pop, you know, mixers are generally going to go that direction with a that famous vocalist. And I was like, you know, we're going Lee Hazelwood here. We, you know, we're this, that's the feel. This is a Nick Cave track.
Yeah.
We can't have a Kylie Minogue or, you know, that kind of classic 90s pop slick sound. So, you know, let's start looking at Space Echoes and, you know, vintage gear. And he said, the remixer said, oh, I bought Brian Eno's Space Echo. There's got quite a pedigree has been run through that. I'll put that on it. And so, you know, it's got the same effect on it that, you know, God, Eno's probably had Bowie and Bono and, you know, yeah. I mean, who knows, everybody, you know, all the greats have probably run through that at one point or another, that's old Space Echo.
You know, one of the things I think is so admirable is that you guys, for the better part of the last 26 years, have been together without falling apart. And it's really hard to be collaborating with anybody for that length of time without someone saying, I think I've had enough of this. But you have been around together for 26 years. I mean, that's crazy to me that you've been able to do that. What do you attribute that to? Is it just deep friendship? Is it just a chemistry? What would you say is keeping that all together?
Probably just straight up high IQ people. We all are very thinky and concerned with how to be, how should we then live, and those kinds of questions. When are you pushing too far? When are you not? You know, I was the only one of us who'd really been in bands and knew the ropes or had seen the ropes. You know, I didn't know the ropes, but So, you know, it was, I was allowed to just basically call the shots and try to direct things as best I could. And then Peter and I were the art directors of the thing. And we had success that way pretty quickly. But, you know, nobody in the band, and we had Hedford, you know, Eric at the time, that obviously didn't work out. He ended up quitting, probably just because of the amount of control that, you know, that it was Pete, me, it was my and Pete's band. And I think, you know, Zia had talked to him a lot about it. And I think that's, you know, that's what she came away with, was it was just, he just couldn't stand. And so he got to put his own band together after that. And they were very good. And he learned what it's like to be the leader of a band. And he was, I can't believe how much I hated being the leader of a band. And they, you know, get anywhere. So he and I we're friends. I really miss him. I really miss being in a band with him. He was a great, just such a solid, exactly what you think of when the term cornerstone, you know, he's not the front arch. He is a cornerstone, and he's very solid. He's funny. He's positive, real positive energy. But it had to happen. So yeah. So I got my cousin in. So Peter and I had been friends since high school. Zia was just a chick that worked at a coffee shop with one of my best friends. And he said, she is amazing. She wants to be in a band. She's super cool. She's really funny. And she's super smart. And so I said, does she play any instruments? And he said, no. And I said, great. Tell her on coffee. And she was just cool and funny and amazing. So, and she was a quick study. I could just show her the keyboard and go, you're going to be playing bass on that. She's like, great. Bass sounds perfect for me because I spend 5 nights a week at dance clubs. So it was, things just kind of worked out. But really it is just being smart enough to know that arguing is not going to really get you anywhere. I mean, a calm debate can maybe change some minds, but, you know, blowing up and having a tantrum and a shit fit just makes people dig in their heels against your opinion when they maybe were on the edge of coming around.
You know, it's interesting you talk about that because I just saw Dig again, you know, recently, and I know it's like the 20th anniversary and there's a new version with 40 minutes added to that.
40 minutes of cocaine is what I was told.
But the way you describe your relationship with your bandmates is interesting because the relationship that, say, you know, Anton Newcombe had with his, and sometimes with his audience and sometimes with everybody around him, is that was the total opposite of what was going on with you. It seemed like you guys were more well suited to succeed and to endure, whereas Anton was just more suited to just implode and self-sabotage. I mean, when you try to compare what you're talking about, you know, with getting along and avoiding the arguments, I mean, it's all right there in that film.
I'm glad it shows up because there isn't one conversation of our band between each other. There isn't really even one conversation of us. She was not interested in anything except anger, frustration, hate, immaturity, and all that kind of ugliness. She knew that that's what people respond to. So I'm really glad that somehow that comes through, because when Brent joined the band, that was the first thing he noticed was anytime we're having a discussion of like, okay, we can't let this happen again. What happened? Who dropped the ball? And how do we fix it? You know, and I noticed that the mic box didn't even get opened on this gig. So everything sounded different, da 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 da, right? Andy Timoner would just be sitting there smiling blankly with the camera sitting on the seat next to her, you know, just waiting for something ugly to happen in case, you know, somebody got angry, then she could pick it up and film it. And so, you know, there's not a lot of real footage of us. There's a lot of takes, you know, like, hey, say you're the most well-adjusted band in America, which we probably were, even with all the bullshit that even we had to deal with back then of each other learning each other's trip. You know, things like that, and, you know, bitching about this. What happened in there? What happened? Whose fault was it? You know, and that kind of thing. Are you going to fire him? And that was sort of what that was to us. It was, you know, obviously we can never go back and film that part of our lives again and really have a true document. So it was sadly a waste of a lot of our lives that we could have just, should have just had somebody else do it that was interested in it. But maybe one of these days I'll watch it again. You know, I haven't, but yeah. Worthwise. It's heartbreaking to me. I think it's just heartbreaking to, because we really thought that it was going to be a document, you know, that we could just sit and watch and enjoy and go, oh, you remember that? Oh, you remember that? But, you know, sadly, it's not.
The narrative that comes out of it is that clearly both you and Anton admired each other. But I think what comes through, and I don't know if it's the filmmaker's your own vision, but, you know, there's something, you know, about, you know, sometimes it's just as hard to see your friends succeed as it is to watch them fail. And I think that kind of came through. And I don't know if that's, if I don't think that's how you felt in that, but it seemed like that was the narrative that was trying to be created in Anton's point of view.
Anton's not a person you can really discuss those things with. You know, I don't know that Anton is a person you discuss anything with. I mean, you just kind of listen, you know, and, you know, you try to, you know, be a part of it and be encouraging. Because he is just, he's really great at expressing all of the feelings that he cannot express in person through music. And, you know, we just played Psych Fest with them. God, they're so beautiful. It's just gorgeous what they do and what he does, you know, and he finds musicians and gets the ones that can do it the way he wants it and needs it to be done to have that kind of psychological and emotional power. They're fantastic. Yeah, he's still fantastic, and I'm a little bit dismayed at what a big face plant he had. But that's what happens when you tour too long. You know, that's why the Dandies really don't tour for more than a couple of weeks at a time. We never go on tour again without having at least a month. And that's just hard working year like this year. We're going to be only having a month off between tours. But usually, you know, we just try to go out 2-3 times a year. As Zia said, when we wanted to take somebody, she said, we can't go a year. Our lives would suck. We can't go a year without going on tour, because otherwise our lives would suck. And it really is a great, it's like vacation plus.
Right. And, you know, you hear about the bands that are, you know, going on for a 2-year tour. Yeah, I don't like being away from the house for like a day. I don't want to stay in a hotel for more than 2 days at a time, and I'm itching to get home.
Yeah, you get a little knot in your stomach that won't go away. Yeah, you just get a little itchy and to, you know, like, what am I doing here? Yeah, I am definitely a homebody. I always have been. But, you know, when you're young, when you're in your 20s, when you're 20-something years old, you can just get in a van and stay out for months. And you know, probably that also has a huge part to play in why Hedford quit, yeah, too. You know, you just get grossed out by each other's quirks and personality quirks and idiosyncrasies, and just people are ugly creatures. We're all pretty gross, and, you know, you have to be a person who really is concerned with being kind, noble, patient, you know, and those beautiful things that we can admire so much in each other. And they're harder and harder to come by nowadays. I think they were easier to come by in our early years. Were truly fringers, and had to have a code of acceptance for each other if you wanted to have any interaction, any meaningful interaction with other people. As a weird fringe artist, you had to be kind and you had to be tolerant. You had to be a good listener, even if you were a big talker.
When you talk about touring, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting, and I don't really understand why this is, but you know, you're certainly not the only band in the world in which this is true. You've had more success overseas than you've had here in the United States. And I don't know if it's a matter of Capital not pushing hard enough here in the States or what that was, but I never really understood why that is.
Capital definitely wasn't particularly interested or knowledgeable in what to do with us. But you got to remember that when we started, if you weren't doing rap rock or commercial radio grunge, you were not considered relevant or valid even. So we were kind of just, put into the cookie cutter that we didn't fit into and spewed out. So we were an underground band here. Europe, the UK, they still were in that place where, you would have Rammstein on the radio followed by Texas or, whatever kind of programmed pop, soft, adult contemporary hits. And it was just more open. Everything was open. And if you had a song that people liked, it worked. Not ironically, when we finally broke through and had a huge record, it was because the president of Capitol Records had gotten fired. And because he made some really bad decisions with a lot of money. And so they brought in an interim president who was a bean counter. He was just an accountant, a really high-end accountant, like Arista Records accountant, right? Which had all of the Whitney Houston and all the big pop stars that, were all Arista at the time. So he got to play president for I don't know, a year or two. And it happened to fall in that time where we released the record. So this wonderfully straightforward man called Jay Krugman called me into his office after I had met the interim president. And he was a sweet guy, a sweet bean counting guy. And I hear this, just kind of joisy, "Hey, Courtney, come in here. Have a seat." And I was just like, "Oh God, here it comes. We're going to get dropped." I'm like, "No, I'll stand for this." And he goes, "Okay, suit yourself." And speaking of suiting yourself, just going to let you know, we're dropping 88 bands or some 112 bands or something. And you're not one of them.
Oh, well, that's good. At least
what we're going to do instead is, we're gonna give you $500,000 advertising budget, and you just spend it however you think best. You could spend it all touring, grassroots, whatever you call it, whatever you guys do. You can be one big fuck off video, big MTV bomb. You can do, you could split it up this way and that way. Hire your own publicity people. Whatever you want to do, you got it. It's a lot of money for a kid like you. So don't fuck it up. Well, we got huge. I did it right. I did something right, at least.
Interestingly enough, this is the same record company that told you you had to redo your second album too. And this is like, they made a lot of interesting decisions with you guys over the years.
Yeah. We were a band that was doing a lot of experimenting with sounds and chemicals. And we just had a lot of different drugs at the time. And so we had never had unlimited budget. We always, we made our first record mostly in my bedroom with all my gear that I had collected and then borrowed some more gear. And we were a band that always built our own studios. So we also didn't have a very experienced engineer to help produce the record with us. So we were whacked off. And it wasn't just Capitol telling us you can't release this. It was Rothrock and all sorts of producers that we were asking for help to finish this record and mix it, saying, "I don't think there's much here. There's not, it's weird. That's cool. But there's not, these visions aren't completed." And we were confused as hell. You know, we've been hearing this stuff and we didn't know what to do. And we, you know, we've never been in this situation before. So we went, we were not surprised, nor were we disappointed when they said, why don't you take a break and go out on some tours? Love and Rockets wanted us to go on tour with them. Blur, the Charlatans, Spiritualized. We had a lot of our heroes interested in us at this point. And so we just did. We took a half a year and we went on some cool tours. We made some lifelong friends, you know, and then we went back in with Tony Lash again, who was very put together, absolutely amazing engineer and a great guy to produce a record with, and came out with Come Down. We did a lot of that at my house as well, but we also, you know, that's when we really started building our own studios, renting it. We had the budget, so we'd rent a space and we would move gear in there and do it that way. And that's what we've done ever since. And then finally, when I made enough money to buy a building, I just bought a building outright and you know, gutted a lot of the rooms and decorated everything, and, you know, Roman columns and, you know, human-sized chessboard floor and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so now we just work there and we don't, you know, we have amazing equipment, lots of vintage gear, you know, all a fully digital, you know, recording platform. So we can build our songs like electronic music is built with that sort of ease and control. But we have the great mics and the great preamps and the great compressors and reverbs and echoes and phasers and processors and all that cool stuff from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, some cool shit from the 90s even actually produced, you know, some amazing equipment. So, yeah. And that's why it takes us a long time to make records, is because we don't have to hurry up and make records.
But the end result of the new one, you know, really shows that there, you know, there's a lot of attention, a lot of hard work on this one. I think Rockmaker is a great record. One of the best you've made in a good long time. So, you have to feel proud of what you've accomplished on this one. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, a lot of our hardcore fans that came to a record listening party. We sold 50 tickets or something, you know, and had a listening party, and we had a lot of those hardcore fans going, I think this might be your best record. So that we've never heard that. You know, we even hardcore fans generally have a previous record they like better. So that bodes well for us, at least being appreciated by our fans, that we are still, you know, we haven't outgrown our having the ears of 14-year-old rockers.
Well, Courtney, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. I'm glad that you were able to talk about the Debbie Harry track. Like I said, I think it's such a great, great song. So congratulations and best of luck on tour.
And thanks for your time and interest too, man. I'm glad you're it's good enough that you're interested and, you know, and you and other people are taking the time to talk to us about it. It's
believe me, it's the pleasure's all mine, Courtney. Thank you so much.
Okay. Right.
Take care of yourself. The name of the new record from the Dandy Warhols is called Rockmaker, and it is absolutely awesome. Thanks for listening. If you liked it, feel free to subscribe to it, review it, share it with everyone you know. Follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. You can also email me at bax@rock102.com. I'd love to hear what you think. Thanks to Metro Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram of Chicopee, and thanks to you for listening to Baxi's Musical Podcast.